We've been studying together the section in the Rambam which deals with most of the fundamentals of Jewish belief. And this particular section deals with the very heavy subject of the kind of damage a person can do to himself that may be irreparable. Who hasn't been here before? Can you hear? For those who are new, this is a section, I feel the need to put this introduction in because not all the things we discuss on Sunday nights are this heavy. You shouldn't get the impression that Torah is a very heavy and frightening burden. It is frightening. Plenty of frightening things as well. But you happen to have stepped in at a time when we're studying that which is heavier. There's a section that deals with things that a person can do wrong that are so bad that they may be irreparable. Now that doesn't mean literally irreparable. If a person does tshuva, which means corrects the actions or thoughts that he did wrong or that she did wrong in the correct way, then definitely they will be negated. But if a person doesn't, and he dies without having corrected these things, then the Rambam says here that there are 13 things that remain with a person in the next world, which means, and he explains here, to the extent that a person has no existence in the next world. We tried to explain last week, it doesn't literally mean no existence, it means a sense of no existence. It's the sensation of not being there. It's not just not being there, that wouldn't be a suffering. It's the suffering of feeling that you should be there and that you aren't, but you're aware of that. We tried to talk about that a bit last week. If you came to be uplifted this evening, now's the time to leave. Okay. That's the nature of the subject. Now, what we looked at last time was, the Rambam says the following thing. He says there are 13 categories here of people who lose their share in the world to come. You're free to ask questions on a Sunday night if it's on the subject and if I'm able to answer it. Feel free to do so. Now, you lose your share in the world to come for these 13 things. Now, we've been through the list and now we started to look at the details. The first, the Rambam said, is somebody's called a min. A group of people called minim. What is exactly minim? I don't know the English word. Something to do with atheists or non-believers or heretics. I don't exactly know what's appropriate English word, but explains it carefully. And last week we saw the first of five sub-categories that fit into this group. And I'll read it to you again. It says, Chamisha heina nikroi minim. There are five groups of people who are called minim. This is the first of 13 categories, okay? There are five subgroups in this group. You can get this in English, by the way, for those who want to revise. You can get it with commentaries, and you can get a very good overview of what's going on. Now, these are the five. First of all, we saw last week, that is somebody who says there is no transcendent level. That means that the world, and that the world has, the world has no leadership or direction, no transcendent power, which means somebody who, we're not going to go into it again, but just as an introduction to the second one, which is tonight's subject, he says that if somebody will clearly believe, hold, that the world is a self-generating thing, not that it either always was this way, or that it manufactured itself, one of those two positions, then such a person is called a min, and that is a reason to have no share in the world to come. We tried to explain a little bit of the depth of it last week along the lines of the fact that, and this is a theme that you have to remember through this whole subject, is that this isn't some primitive belief that you have to believe a certain thing in order to have a ticket. That we don't have such a concept. That there are other religions, and unfortunately many people in Judaism who don't have the depth to understand, they think that you have to do certain things in order to have a ticket. You have to fulfill certain requirements in order to qualify for whatever it may be, reward in the next world. We don't have such a view. The depth of it is this, that you don't have to fulfill requirements in order to get a ticket. The requirements build yourself. That's what it is. And the next world is just an experience of who you are. That's the concept. Which means it's not a reward or a punishment, it's just a consequence. If you build yourself into the kind of being who could live in the next world, so then what happens is you deserve to live in the next world, not as a reward, but you're able to live there because that's what you are. It's actually very simple to understand. The next world, one thing we know about it, let's assume today that we've already proved that existence is such a thing. We have dealt with that in the past also, but let's take it for granted just because we can't prove everything all at once. Not that we can ever prove this necessarily. But let's take it for granted that it's worthwhile considering the possibility of such a thing. And anybody who attends a shiur like this probably has decided in his mind, I imagine, that it's worth considering the possibility of such a thing, which is the wise attitude to take. What we know about the next world, if we know anything about it, is that it's not physical. That we know. We don't see any physical dimension that's after this one. On the contrary, when this one ends, we see this integration. We don't see a dimension that follows this. So one thing we can say about that dimension, if and where and when it exists, is that it's a spiritual dimension, which means abstract from our point of view. But that's our belief in it, that it's that of that nature. Now, which means the following thing, that if you want to have an existence there, you have to be spiritual. For sure, as a body, you don't have an existence there. That's an axiom of Jewish belief, and he's going to say it a number of times. We'll see it also in the next one. Which means that the body you for sure don't take with you, and physical possessions for sure you don't take with you. So if you do exist there, if there is such a thing, which we haven't experienced, but if there is such a thing, then the only thing that could possibly be there is a refined inner spiritual force. So the concept we have is this, that if that's what you are, if that's what you take your life energy and transform it into spiritual being, so then when you enter a dimension where the only thing that can exist there is spiritual existence, so then you exist. But if you spend your life generating, translating all the energy that you have and all the potential that you have into a physical being, so then what you have is a very powerful physical being. But when the physical being disintegrates, so disintegrates, nothing left. Are you with me? There's not a punishment or reward, it's just a consequence. Let's just look at it one level deeper. I tried to say this last week in different ways. Maybe it's more clear now. You could say it in the following way, that what you're given when you're born is a tremendous amount of potential. That's all you have, really. You have a certain amount of time, a certain amount of health, certain background, certain family factors, certain financial situation, a whole constellation of factors that are your potential. And, of course, into this comes whom you'll meet in life, the opportunities that will be presented to you above and beyond what you can generate, all the givens that are outside of your free choice. That's what you're born with. That's who you are, basically. In Jewish terms, that's what you are. You are this unformed bundle of potential. What you end up as, not 120 years later, is what you've done with that raw material. And as we've discussed here many times. But that's all you are. The materials you were given to build that state that you end up in or as, those materials disappear. The potential disappears. In fact, our concept of the next world is exactly that it's a place where there's a lack of potential. That's our definition of the next world. That's the sadness of the next world. That you can't develop at all. It's a static place. In mystical terms, it's not a static place, but perhaps we'll have time to discuss that later or another time. But in terms of developing yourself at the static place, you can't do anything to develop because you don't have any tools. The only way you can develop is when you take something that's a tool, what we call a kli, broader than a tool. It means anything that you can work with, and you use it to develop something. But in that existence, you don't have any kli. You just raw potential or actualized potential. But you don't have anything, there's no change. You can't generate any change. That's the sadness of that world. So what it means is this, that you're born with all this potential, connected to a physical being, which is your tool. That's the organ, the organs, the limbs, to be able to apply that potential, what they call in the mystical language, to bring from the potential into the actual. To bring from the potential world into the actual world. That's what you have to do. When you end up, what the measure of who you are and what you are, is just what have you done with this raw material. Are you with me? Which is why we have to look at the world in totally, we mentioned this in many other ways also, the Jewish view of the world is exactly the opposite of the secular view. The secular or non-Jewish view of the world is that we look only at your gifts. We look at your raw materials. That's what we idolize people for having, right? For their talents, for their looks. Well, that's what the world sees in people. But in Judaism, we look at the world exactly the opposite. We don't look at somebody's talents or gifts or looks. We look at what he's busy doing with those talents or looks or gifts. Right? On the contrary, we see them as a liability in a way, because that's where you're going to be held to account. I mean, just to give you one application of this idea, it can make an enormous difference in life. The simplest and most obvious application of this idea is in education. The secular world brings up children, praising them for their natural talents and abilities. If a child's good looking, so especially a girl, they're made to feel that as they grow up, and they identify with their own sense of identity, sense of self, goes around those talents. It's a terrible thing to do. It's a terrible thing to do. That doesn't stimulate a person to develop in any way. The Jewish point of view is to focus on a child's abilities and talents and gifts, and to encourage and reward and appreciate what the child's doing with those gifts. You see, the difference that this makes is I'm sure you can figure out for yourself, many, many differences and happiness that it can generate. But one obvious example is, in the secular world, if a child is born not talented or disadvantaged in some way, if a child in the secular world is born, let's say, not good looking, not embarrassed about their physical appearance, so that child's a loser from the day he starts out. That child will be made to feel bad, they'll suffer at the hands of their friends, they will have a miserable existence, and it usually doesn't get better when they're older. Because they're made to feel like a failure from the beginning. And the kids who have natural gifts are made to feel like they're the successors in the world. In a Torah system, it doesn't work that way at all. No one ever focuses on a child because they're good-looking. There's nothing to praise about being good-looking. It's not your fault. And you didn't do it. Why do you deserve praise for this thing? On the contrary, when a child in the Torah world is looked at in terms of what they're generating with what they have, so it means everybody starts out exactly equal. Because everybody's being judged only against what they could be doing in the world. So when a child of very moderate ability achieves something moderate, so he gets praised in a very powerful way, because for him he's achieving something that's a very big achievement. So he's judged only against himself. In a Torah school, nobody gets marks. In the real Torah system in Yeshiva, no one gets marks compared to other kids' marks. Marks compared to another child are irrelevant. Why should one child be compared with a mark against another child when he has different abilities? Other different circumstances. Definitely doesn't make any sense. His child must be given a mark relative to his own ability, so he knows how he's coping with what he could be doing. But we don't do that in the secular system. We make a miserable child, not even more miserable, by comparing him against somebody else who's got more ability. So he'll never do as well as that child, and he'd be made to feel like a failure. It's the cruelest thing you can think of. See, I didn't enjoy school. But that's not the way it should work. So again, our view of the world is this, that, and even when it comes to physical things that you can't deny are important, in the Torah world it also doesn't function that way. Because first of all, we de-emphasize physical beauty, right? We de-emphasize it as an end in itself. Right? What a young man looks for in a wife in the Torah system, the first thing that he should look for, just in case you start thinking too frum, the first thing that he should look for is something that is natural. It must be chemistry. The halacha is that he's not allowed to marry a woman without seeing her. Not just because on paper she has the right specifications, it's not allowed. He has to actually see her at least once. More than that, not, but at least once. Because he has to know that there's a physical attraction, because that's the heart of marriage. If that's functioning well, usually the other problems can be sorted out. If that area is not functioning well, it's not exactly the forum to go into it, but if that area is not functioning well, then you have a lot of problems. So that is an area, no one's denying that it's important, and perhaps it comes first, if you like, there's no question. But that's not the basis on which he chooses the wife. When that factor's there, he then looks at somebody who has an inner beauty and somebody who has the things that he wants in a human being. But exactly the opposite in the secular world. One of the saddest things that I personally have to deal with, and lots of people do, most families these days, is the sad choices that people make in marriage in a secular system. Our Jewish community of people who've been brought up without knowing how to think about these things in a Jewish way. So they make such unwise choices because they don't even think about the subject in the first place. They just get involved in a passive way because they happen to have got involved. And for one thing leads to another. After that, the emotions are engaged. And after that, often it leads to, these days it's very seldom, these days it doesn't usually, marriage is not what it used to be these days. Many times it can drag on for years while usually the woman gets badly battered emotionally because the young man is just living up to the image of the Western successful man, other than to think about marriage. But when they do get married, you'll find that it's not a couple who chose each other on a Torah basis. They chose each other because they happen to kind of fall into each other's path in some way, often based on a physical attraction or a superficial attraction. When a person chooses a wife or a husband from a Torah point of view, you should look for a list of things. That's not a subject tonight. But first of all, there's some people sitting here who aren't even looking. I happen to know that. First thing is you must start looking. Let's try. But after that, what you should look for is not the first object that crosses your path looking like it's about to take a bath, but rather somebody who has certain requirements. First of all, there must be a physical attraction. But the physical attraction must be one that you see in proportion. That's why we insist that women dress modestly. They have to dress in a very feminine way, but they must dress modestly, so that a man has half a chance of seeing her both as a feminine and attractive being and also as a human being. As a human being, as somebody with something inside. That's why we insist on that. That's the first thing. But then beyond that, she should be healthy if possible. And a young woman should look for a man who's basically healthy. Basically, if possible. and mentally healthy should go into that. People don't even bother with that. How many people have come to me with a problem that arose months, years after marriage, they didn't even bother to think about it in the first place, where there was a major problem in the beginning. And after that, you should look for somebody. The most important thing after that is midas. A person should be a gentle and giving kind of person. They should be normal, open, giving, gentle, kind person. If you marry such a person, you've got a very high chance of achieving success, provided that right after that you try and become gentle and kind and giving, which you probably aren't. But then you've got a chance. But if you marry somebody who's hung up about something, or most things, who just happens to have one feature that caught your eye, so that's going to be a problem. But I'm only emphasizing this because the way you look at things in life, about the way it comes, I mean, it's just common sense. It's not even Jewish. This is not spiritual or Torah. It's just common sense. Think about it, you'll see it's very embarrassing. Most men end up marrying somebody whom they thought about much less carefully than the next car they're about to buy. You think about it. If you ask a man what he knew about his wife, really, what he really knew about her background and her midas, did he ever think about it, and her inner content, and how many people haven't come to me with a problem where they've got married, been married for 3 months, and he wants to be sterilized, or he wants her to be sterilized, or he doesn't want children at all. She wanted 15 children, not as many as possible. So they haven't discussed the subject. But they contracted a marriage where they committed themselves to the rest of their lives and never discussed that subject. But that doesn't make any sense at all. Now, he doesn't even know what her attitude is about those things, what her attitude is about having a Jewish home, or about spiritual values. Never bothered to discuss it. But the next car that he buys, or the last one, he can probably tell you its cubic displacement to the nearest millimeter, probably. And every other detail is researched thoroughly. And he can contrast and compare it to all the other models that are around. And he knows it in great detail. But the woman that he's acquiring here for the rest of his life is much more important. It is much more important. He hasn't actually been into in detail. Okay, so all I'm trying to say is that from a Torah point of view, you have certain priorities. Now, the inner aspect of who the person is, that's what counts. And that's what should be emphasized. And therefore, the thing that a person should look at in a woman, even from a physical point of view, the first thing is a natural physical attraction that should be there. But right after that, you should see, what does this woman do with her physicality? Right? How does she use her physical being? And there's an inner beauty in every woman. We have mentioned this before on Sunday nights, I think. There's an inner beauty in every woman that shines through the physical beauty. That you don't have to be born looking a certain way for that to be manifest. But unfortunately, that isn't emphasized, that's not rewarded or appreciated in society. And so women are forced, or they allow themselves to be battered into trying to show off the coarsest and crudest of a physical manifestation. So let's get back to where we began. What we're trying to understand is this, that there's an inner feeling, there's an inner being, there's something deeper than just the surface, and that thing is what you are doing with yourself. Right? In other words, again, not the physical meat or tissue that carries you around, but how you shine through that, how are you using that, how you manage in every way your deportment, how you move, the words you choose not to use, the kindness that you show, so many things that you do with all the organs and tools at your disposal, every second of your time, that's what we look at in a person. Now, the biggest tool that you have is time. That means every second of your life is an opportunity to use this whole constellation of factors to achieve something. It doesn't matter how short or long it is. Right? You're not judged. It's not going to be held against you because you had less years. Somebody had less years than somebody else. Not going to be held against you that way. It's going to be held against you. You had X amount of years. Did you achieve the maximum potential with that time? And every second that a person wasted, definitely going to be held against them. Because that was raw potential that you didn't use. I was once present in the house of my Rebbe after his daughter died. He lost a daughter who was 15. And she was very sick and dragged on for a long time. Finally, she was nifta. So I went to the house while he was an offer. So he was sitting on the floor and he was crying. So the people there, somebody was speaking to him about it. And I heard him say the following thing. First of all, he explained who she was. I hadn't known that. When you understand who this girl was, this comment that he made makes much more sense. There was a girl who never complained once. She went through agony. I can tell you medically. She went through a constant agony for a long time. I happen to know that on the last day of her life, she was unable to breathe. She had only one lung functioning at that time, and that had deteriorated. So she went to school that day. She didn't say anything. She went to school. She went off to Beis Yaakov. She never complained ever. The only thing she ever said about it was she told her father not to worry, because she told him that she knows for sure she's going to a place that's better than this, and so he shouldn't be upset. That's the only thing she said about it. Okay? She's a remarkable individual who stimulated people to greatness. There are many things that have been done in Yerushalayim in her memory. He explained a few things about her. And at the end, he said the following thing. He said, some people have to do a certain job, and some people manage in 15 years. Some people have 15 years to do a certain job, and they do the job. Other people have to do a job, and they take much longer to get the job done. So what he said, what I understood from that was that she had a certain job to do. There was a certain tickle she had to make in her neshama. She came down 15 years, and that amount of suffering was exactly what she needed, and she finished off the job. And what frightened me particularly, better hold on to your seat for this, about this was that as if that wasn't enough, as if I didn't understand it deeply enough from what he said, another child of his, an older daughter, had a daughter. Right? That means a grandchild was born 3 months after this. So they named that child after this child. Now you know that when we name someone after someone else, it has a very powerful effect of bringing down their neshama again. It's in fact a kind of reincarnation. That means that this new girl who was born, they named her after the previous child, and 3 months later the child didn't wake up one morning. Right? That means it's as if that neshama was just not meant to be. That neshama had done something, it had to do whatever it had to do, try to bring it down again, it was finished already, so it didn't hang around. Right? What do we understand? That there's a job that has to be done, and you get a certain amount of time to do it in with a certain amount of tools at your disposal. Now, our understanding of the next world is that the totality of what you've built up with those tools in that amount of time is what you are. It's not a reward, it's what you are. Okay? Now, so let's understand. We said in the beginning that the next world, if it's anything, it's a spiritual place or dimension. So if a person, let's say, they take that totality of what their potential is, right? Let's say they have, were given 70 years. Let's say a person was given, oh, what are you, 120 years. And that was 120 years with a certain amount of potential, certain kind of physical build, certain amount of intelligence, certain opportunities. And what did they do? They spent 120 years building only physicality. Let's say a person's every thought were devoted to building muscle, right? And to looking and to being healthy in a physical sense only. So that person would have no existence in the next world. Right? I mean, we're taking an extreme case. Because he only built that which lives here. So when that disappears, so there's nothing left. But a person who paid no attention to the physical, not only to the spiritual, which of course means paying attention to the physical as a vehicle for the spiritual, but he did that perfectly, built himself into a purely spiritual being, exercised self-control in all the areas that a person has to, refined the inner being, so in the next world that person has an existence, because that's all the next world is. In other words, it's a translating. Your job here is to take all, if you like, the currency, the money that you were given when you were born, the currency that you have, which is your own power and potential, and spend it to buy the goods. The goods being you, being the developed you that you could be, the increase in the raw material that you could make. Your own. You've put the question in a very easy way to answer. If a person did the best they could, that's perfection. If a person did the best they could, there's no such thing as that not being enough. The best they could do. If they did that, under the circumstances, in the time given, with all the disadvantages and suffering and everything else, that's not just good enough, that's perfection. The best they could do, under the circumstances. Are you with me? If a person had only a few years and they were difficult and painful, but he did the best that he could do in the circumstances, that's perfection. Perfection. He will end up on the same level as Moshe Rabbeinu says, who did the best he could do with what he was given. There'll be no difference at all. That's clear. That's the good news. The bad news is if you think you're doing what you could be doing, in case you think, I'm not being personal, yeah, but in case anybody thinks that they're doing the best that could be done under the circumstances, so you are heavily misled. Right? Because we haven't even begun, I don't think there's anybody in this generation, virtually, who's even begun to understand that there even might be such a subject, let alone have actually started to work on their potential. Unfortunately, situation. The story that I always tell to illustrate that, which is worth hearing, is that, I'll tell it to you again, those of you who've heard it, I'm sure. The Netziv was a man who was the leader of his generation. He was a Torah sage in the early part of this century, who was a giant in Torah, in terms of personal development, in terms of what he contributed in Torah. He was a person whose opinion was sought from all over the world. He was somebody who was achieved an amazing level, right? One of the luminaries of this generation. So his nephew, the Torah Tamima, writes about him, and he writes quite openly that he was of very, very modest abilities. In fact, it was known that when the Netziv was young, some Torah giants start out with phenomenal prodigious abilities. Rabbi Chaim Loizer, I mean, when he was 13, he knew the commentaries on the commentaries on the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch by heart already. And there were those who knew things when they were 6 and 7 that we wouldn't. But they were people of phenomenal. Rabbi Chaim Loizer used to write 2 tshuvas with both hands at the same time and speak to a third person all at once. There were people who saw that. He'd answer 2 halachic queries in tshuvas with the right and the left hand, 2 different ones, and speak to a third person in learning at the same time. Okay, there are people who saw that and get it more right than the scribble. I mean, things that have been preserved to this day. I think, okay, he was of phenomenal ability. But then Tzvi was of less than average ability, and he became one of the greatest in the world. So the frightening story that's told about him is that when he was an old man, a leader of his generation, one of the most famous Torah sages, minds in the world, he met someone who had been together with him in Cheder when they were little children. They hadn't seen each other for many years. But this man, of course, had heard of the fame of the great Netziv. Rav Naftali Tzvi Berlin was his name. So he came up to the Netziv and he said, look, I hope you don't mind my asking you, but I don't mean to embarrass you, but I remember that when we were young in Cheder, you were very, very average. You were below average. You really, you know, you just didn't have what it took. You know, how did you get to this level? It was the problem that bothered you. You struggled to cope at school. Now, the rest of us did okay, and you were below. You struggled. How did you end up the greatest of this generation? So then Tzib answered him the following thing. He said, look, as I got a little older, I said to myself, I came to an age where I said to myself, look, you have to decide what you're going to be in life. What are you going to be? So I said to myself, let's be honest about it. What are my abilities? And I said to myself, look, you're really not gifted in learning, right? You're not going to be anything great in learning. So you go, you'll make a living, you'll do honest day's work, you'll learn as much as you can, you'll say to him, you know, you'll amount to whatever you can, and you'll say. That night, when I said that to myself, I made that decision, that night I had a dream. In my dream, I finished my life, I was an old man and I finished my life, and I went up to the next world, and there they told me that I was being judged. You know, the court case that you go through, you get judged. So they put me in the dock, and they said, you're on trial for murder. So I said, no, you've got the wrong man, I never killed anybody. So they said, no, you killed the Netziv. So I said, what do you mean? So they said to me, do you know what you could have been if you would have worked despite all your disabilities? If you would have worked in a superhuman fashion for the rest of your life? Do you know what you could have been if you would have, against all odds and against everybody telling you that it wasn't possible, if you would have worked every second of your life with a superhuman energy, right, in an impossible way, you would have been one of the greatest men of your generation. So I woke up in a sweat and I said to myself, can't take a chance. So I worked for the rest of my life until now. You hear that? I worked from then until now in an unbelievable, way. May that story come back and plague you. Yes, please. Understand your question. I tried to prevent your question by saying that in the mystical point of view, there is development over there. Very briefly, that's this little sidetrack. It is on the subject, but a little off the main theme. The idea is this. There is change in the next world. Stay with me carefully. There is change in the next world, but it's change that's a passive acceleration generated by what you did. But you can't change that over there. Are you with me? It's like this. It says in the deeper mystical sources that in fact if it were a static place, it would be very painful. Because as soon as you'd got used to that level, then the only ecstasy over there is the constant growth, right? And anybody who knows anything about life knows that any situation of constancy you immediately stop sensing. You follow, it's only a change that you sense. Are you with me? There's a very deep intimate area over here also, but I can't go into that now. You ask me privately. But it's only when there's emotion of change that you have any sensation in all modalities of the body and the mind also. So in the next world, it says that the reward of the next world is a sensation of constant developing, getting closer and closer to Hashem at an exponential rate. That means at the speed of light, exponentially getting faster, you're getting closer and closer and higher and higher. Okay? There are many sources. There's one source that says tzaddikim in the next world have a ring dance around Hashem. That means they dance in a circle and Hashem is the center. Whenever we have such a description in the mystical writings, it means a ring dance, a circle always means a spiral. It means going round, and each turn is higher than the one before, like the year we go through. That's what it means. There are many other sources that say it. Are you with me? In other words, it's not a static place at all. It's a fantastically developing place. But the problem with it is, in terms of what you do to accelerate that development, what you do to make a change, right? One tiny mitzvah that you'd love to do, because it will rocket you ahead, it will give you an untold reward, ecstasy, spiritual being. You can't do that mitzvah because you've got no body to do it with. You don't have a hand to give the few pennies with anymore. You don't have a body to put tzitzis on. So you can't do that mitzvah. That's a tremendous agony. That's why when the Gaon was dying, they say when the Gaon of Vilna died, as he was dying, he cried. So the Talmidim said to him, Rebbe, why are you crying? If anybody could be happy about where he's going, surely it's you. He said, I'm not sad about where I'm going. I'm sad to be leaving a world as beautiful as this, where for a few pennies you can do a mitzvah. That's what he said. But the understanding of what he said, what he meant was, he wasn't being sentimental. What he meant was that in this world, for a few pennies, you can buy tzitzis and put them on your clothes. So you can transform a physical thing here into spiritual power. But in the next world, no matter how much you want to, and all you want to do there is that, right? In the next world, you can't do that. That's the sadness of the next world. Of course, the happiness is that you have the real thing. That's why when we go to a cemetery, Loyal Landon, we put our tzitzis in. Don't walk through a cemetery with your tzitzis out. Because it pains the people who are there. They'd love to be wearing tzitzis. They give anything for that. And here you're mocking them by the fact that you're able to do it. So we don't do that to them. You follow? So it's not a static place. In fact, one of the most amazing illustrations of this thing that you've asked, can't you find a seat? One of the most amazing things that's an illustration of what you've asked is this. There's an amazing spiritual description of the fact that this world is called long and the next world is called wide. We did discuss this once on a Monday night 2 weeks ago. But one of the meanings of that thing is that this world is called long because length means movement. Right from one point to the next. The next world is only wide. Wide is comfortable. The wider, the more comfortable, but it doesn't mean any more progress. If the road is wide, it doesn't help you get where you're going. It's just nicer to get there. Follow me. So the next world is a world of width. I once heard a great man describe it. He said, you've tried to put it into a modern, Yerushalmi Rebbe, he put it into a very beautiful modern idiom. He said that this world is like plodding through a storm at night. So you're plodding through the mud, you can't see where you're going. And every step, 3 steps forward, you get blown, 2 steps back, and you get stuck in the mud and know where you're going. And at the end of many, many hours of toil, you might have a few steps to your credit. The next world, but of course that's everything. The next world is you're sitting on a supersonic liner. You follow? And you're sitting back and they're serving you caviar and champagne. I don't know if that's what you like. But you're going at a supersonic speed. You hear what's going on? Relative to yourself, you're sitting still. You follow me? It's a place where you sit still. You sit back. It's wide. But the thing is moving at an incredible rate. You hear what's going on? In other words, relative to your own energies, this is a place where you make tremendous effort and there's very little development in terms of absolute speed. You follow me? But it's everything because you did it. Up there, there's nothing you can do, but they're carrying you. So in terms of the outside speed, it's a beautiful, beautiful marshal, because if you think about it, we call that sitting. I don't know if you know, but mystically we talk about lying, sitting and standing are the three different phases of the day. It's all mystical, it's a mystical subject. But that phase, that's called sitting. Sitting means a situation in which you move only because you carry it, but you don't generate change. And a fantastic illustration, most amazing illustration of that, and of course that's why the word to sit in Hebrew always means sadness. You know that? I'm a shiva. Well, that's what it means, the 7 days. But sitting is always a lashon of sadness. Like it says, Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov wanted to sit. It means he wanted to have a little bit of rest in this world, and that's when his troubles really began. Because to sit in this world, to be passive, not to develop, is the ultimate sadness. Right? That's not what you're here for. So sitting is always an expression of sadness. So how come we talk about a yeshiva? A yeshiva, a place where you learn Torah, is called a place where you sit. Yeshiva means to sit down. You hear the question? My Rebbe asked this question. It's a beautiful question. The Jewish people, every word that we use, every little custom is loaded with significance. So how come we take the holiest place on earth as a place that people learn Torah? It means where they really develop. And we give that place the name of sitting, which means non-development. You hear the question? Because that's the place where you develop the most. That's the fastest moving place on earth. That's where all your energies are put into working on yourself. Not like outside where a small proportion of them may be. So why is it called sitting? So the answer from what we've discussed this evening is beautiful, obvious. Because that's the one place in the world you can sit down. If there's one place in which you can be carried, if there's one place you can put your burden down, you follow? If there's one place relative to the outside world, relative. Nobody says you sit in yeshiva, you work harder than any place else in yeshiva, else you don't grow at all. You follow? But relative to a world where a lot of what you do is not developmental, so it's a fantastic idea. You follow? Relative to yourself in yeshiva, you don't sit at all. But relative to the world that's going crazy out there, that's moving and moving and moving, not getting anywhere, so that's the one place you can sit. A beautiful life. That's a basic answer to your Yeah, before we begin tonight's subject, are there any more questions? Okay, so we need that introduction to understand what we said last week in more depth and what we're about to look at. So that what we want to take with us is this. That what you are in the next world is simply what you've built. Now, with that understanding, we can understand one more point about what we said last week. Last week we said this, the first of the five subcategories of people who don't have any share in the world to come because they don't have any belief. So, at first glance it looks a little tough. This person didn't believe in Hashem. He wasn't aware of a transcendent being, so he has no share in it. But looked at more deeply with tonight's understanding, what we discussed, you can understand it much more deeply. This person doesn't live in that world because he isn't building it. You follow? It's not a punishment. That means, what does it mean not to believe in a world to come? What does it mean not believing in Hashem, not believing in any transcendence? And we don't mean believing, as we discussed before. It means knowing. The Jewish obligation is not to believe. You're not supposed to become the bamboozled kind of zombie or a groupie that sort of says, who says he believes. That's not the object. The object is to study until you know and to learn about life from a depth that brings you knowledge of the subject. Not good enough to walk around convincing yourself. That's not what we're striving for. Certain cults might do that, but that's not what we're doing. We're trying to achieve knowledge of the spiritual world. But a person who deliberately achieves no knowledge of the spiritual world and defiantly declares that there is no such thing and works on himself. So what's that person doing? He's living here. He's living here and now. Where else is he living? He's not investing in any other dimension. He tells you there isn't any. So he's living only here. So of course he doesn't have a share in it because not building it. You follow? Not when Hashem is vindictively holding it against him. The only existence you have in the next world is the investment you made there. Is it clear? And therefore, since he's not making any investment, which means he's just not building it, he's right. That's the irony. He ends up right. The person that tells you there is no world to come is absolutely right. He can sense it and he knows it and he's right about it. And it's only a person who knows it so intimately that he builds it, he's right about that too. You follow? That's exactly what it is. The only difference is when you look at the evidence, what conclusion you come to, that's all. You look at this world and you say, well, it looks physical, so that's all there is. So that's your conclusion. Somebody else looks at the world with depth and understands what's going on here, what a human being really is, and he sees the shine of a human being and he understands what the world is and its beauty and its potential. So he understands there must be more than meets the eye over here. Depends what the conclusion is. You don't give the child the intellectual explanation. The child, you simply tell him as a fact. Believe me, if a child is brought up with an intense awareness of this from his parents, even then it's hard enough for him to relate to it correctly when he gets older. But if you let the child work it out when he's, you know, as the secular world says, well, I'm not against religion, I'm going to give my child a fair start in, I'm not going to tell him anything about religion, I'm going to let him figure it all out for himself. When he gets to an age, he'll make his own decision. You know what kind of decision that child's going to make when he gets to the age where physicality is so important and that sort of. Therefore, the Jewish approach is you don't give a child a choice about that. You give a child tremendous intense awareness of these things and you show it to him in the world. You don't get him to intellectualize about it. You show him what is a tree. You show him to appreciate what it is and to appreciate what it means to have his body and what it means. And you give him, so he actually feels these things, and when he gets old enough to think about it intellectually, by the way, since you're a woman, I'll tell you that the strength of this idea lies only with women. Do you know that? The Jewish woman maintains this strength in the Jewish people. It's one of the reasons why women are not encouraged to study Gemara. I don't know if you know this. One of the reasons why traditionally Jewish women do not study Talmud is because it's a very analytical, cold, intellectual exercise. Why don't we want women to do that? Before the feminists start throwing anything. Oh, exactly. You see, the woman who's in touch knows this already. Only if you try to make yourself into a man through being a rampant feminist, then you won't understand this idea. The idea is this. A man needs intellectual discipline. Right? Men don't know this, but any woman knows that a man is a totally undisciplined creature. He's the victim of his ego. That's all a man is. Just an inflamed ego. That's what a man is, basically. He needs intellectual discipline to bring himself under control. He needs a lot of work on himself. A woman has a gift. This is a... I'm not talking about exceptions. I'm talking about the mainstream idea for now. A kosher Jewish woman, anyway, is somebody who has a tremendous connection with reality. That's what it says in the mystical world. She knows what's real because she knows it, not because she works it out intellectually. And if you put her through the cold, divorcing exercise of becoming analytical intellectually, you stand a chance of ruining her natural connection with reality. Do you understand that? A woman knows what it means to be a mother. She knows what it means to give love. She knows what it means to nurture. There are many things a woman knows with such a depth that the only way you can ruin it, women know that to the extent that you can take their life sooner than take that from them, right? And you, unless you get them to intellectualize, in a cold, analytical way, divorced from reality, you can get them to start thinking too much and lose what they have naturally. That is the danger of intellectualizing. It's an amazing thing. And that's why it's a woman who has to give this over to a child and not a man. And by the way, I heard from a very great person. He said the following words, unbelievable thing. He said the following thing. He said what the most, I'm paraphrasing his words, but very close to these words, he said that an ordinary Jewish woman of two generations ago, right? Not an outstanding Jewish woman, an ordinary, unlearned Jewish woman of our great-grandmother's generation had more heart in her than the greatest people of this generation. Right? You follow? The woman, the breakdown of Jewish values, the last place it occurred is in women. They were the ones who held on to it the longest. Right? They never needed yeshivas even, do you know that? In order to be able to give their lives for Hashem and bring out that flaming devotion to Hashem and to Torah that the Jewish people has had, men needed to batter themselves into shape for centuries. But women managed just by handing down from mother to daughter. It's only recently, two generations ago, that they started the idea of yeshivas for women, where they could actually learn these things explicitly and try and pick up things that they didn't get from their mothers, but it's a breakdown. It's a terrible breakdown. Women never needed that. They handed over such a depth of understanding of all that Judaism is from their mothers and from their families that it was a woman's natural and special gift. She has to work in other areas. She has to know how to bring that out. Yeah, somebody wants to also. You don't have to stand there. No, he attains a measure of beauty in this world because that's where he puts the investment. We did discuss this a bit. I don't know if you were here last week. Were you? So we discussed, first of all, you must understand that just briefly, before we can answer your question, you have to know that people who don't believe in the next world because they don't know anything about it are not in this category. Okay? We're talking about people who really know what it means, this whole mystical spiritual thing, and they reject it from a negative, you follow, a violent, deliberate negative action. We're not talking about Jews who weren't brought up knowing anything about spirituality, who thought that Torah was sort of sermonizing from a pulpit and Knedlich and Pesach, and that's the idea of Judaism. They don't know this anymore. They think that it's the Easterns who know about reincarnation and spirituality. You follow? Such a person is not included in the person who loses his share in the world to come. He's not an atheist, he's just uninformed. Are you with me? That's the first step you have to know. But if somebody really takes it seriously, let's answer your question at that level. He really holds there's no world to come. But why is he doing good things here? Why is he doing good things here? He's just a gorilla. You follow? He believes that what you see is what there is. When he disintegrates, so what's the higher system? But he does it anyway. Let's say this person has got some idea and he says that you must do good things. Okay? So invests goodness and energy and effort in this world. So it says such a person gets a reward in this world. He gets a reward. What else can Hashem do? That's the only place he admits of. It's the only thing he wants. You follow? So Hashem pays him out with fantastic wealth in this world. Wealth and happiness in this world. That's what it says. So one of the pathways to understand why people who may not look positive on the outside in certain ways have a fantastic time here. Hashem pays them out because he'd love to pay them out in the next world. And especially for mitzvahs that are transcendent, that do belong in the next world. But the person isn't allowing him to. You follow me? The person has made such an investment here that he's not... You know, they can't put money in a bank account that you haven't opened. That's basically the... But he does get reward in this world. Actually, the truth is that there are very few people in this generation that fit into the category of your question. There are very few people in this generation who, A, know about the spiritual reality, they've really studied Torah, they know what it means. B, after knowing it, they really reject it, consciously. And C, they're still doing good things here. You follow? Very rare to find that. Most Jews that you're talking about are people who have a genuine sense of goodness. They just don't know too much about spirituality. I haven't been into it. No one ever taught them about that. So they're doing good because they feel that they're good. They feel that motivation. They have a sense of nobility and something higher. They're spontaneously motivated to do that. So that is definitely. It says the simplest Jew in the Gemara. It says the biggest sinner in the Jewish people, the lowest Jew you can find, is Malei Mitzvos Karimon. That's what it says. Full of mitzvahs like a pomegranate. Has seeds. That's the lowliest even. Yeah, that's not sad. I understand your question. The question was, what happens to a person who is talented in a very physical way? Let's say a person is very good physically, right? At sport or at music or art. So we have a principle like this, that there's no talent that you're allowed to waste. Absolutely not. It's an obligation for that mother or that individual to develop that talent. But to channel it into a direction where it will have lasting value. Do you know what you can do with physical talents? Do you know what you can do with musical and artistic ability? Do you know what happiness you can bring to people? Do you know what mitzvah activity you can generate in the world if you're talented in that way? Do you know what, you know how, you follow me, if you connect well with people. Every talent in the world you'll find, the more pronounced it is, the more damage you can do with it, and the more benefit you can do. There's nothing that's weighted either way. Let's say you're slick with people. You get on very well, you can put ideas across very well, let's say. You know what? You can do tremendous harm with that. You can get millions of people to follow you in a perverted path, or you could bring people to righteousness. You follow. If you're wealthy, that's an ability, that's a talent, that's something you've been given. So wealth can buy fantastic goodness, and it can buy tremendous destruction. There's nothing in the world. The only interesting point about this is, in people who were not religious before and become observant, there are two pathways of relating to this problem. I'll just tell you as a fact. There are two kinds of personality. One personality likes to take all the talents that it used in an unkosher way in the past and sanctify them by chopping them off. You'll find Balei Tshuva who use their talents in an unkosher way. Talents with opposite sex, maybe, with other people, with certain areas where they were slick and achieved. So when they become frum, they have very, very sour taste in their mouths about things that they did. So the way they relate to those talents, they end them completely, they sacrifice them to Hashem, and they never relate to them again. Others are unable to do that, and what they do is they take all those talents and they channel them into the right application and sanctify them in that way. Which is the way that any individual should do? So it depends on your personality. I have a tradition from a very great man whom I asked this question. He said no talent was given to be wasted, and there's nothing in the world that reaches its fulfillment only by being denied. There are exceptions like anger. Complete all-out anger is there only for you to control. It never has an application. I mean real anger where you lose control. Not righteous indignation. That's what it's there for. But total, there are something. But generally speaking, but it depends on your personality. I have a brother-in-law. We got involved in becoming much more interested and knowledgeable at the same time. He's also a doctor. We have followed very similar pathways. He has a personality. He was very, very talented in many areas. He was a youth movement leader, one of the best. He uses none of that at all, ever. He won't use any of all the things that he was famous for. He was best at. He uses none of them today. Why? Because he feels that he just cannot channel them without bringing some taint of what they were before. So he's radically changed his personality. He's absolutely controlled and changed his personality. And I, having gone along with him, haven't done that. I haven't been able to do that. So we had a massive argument about it. We always argue about it. He went to us, you know, and I was told for me that that's the way. But I think it depends. You'd have to know the basic personality. I'm the kind of person, I never throw anything out. You follow? I got nails and screws that I've had for 25 years because I don't know. My brother-in-law, when he cleans up the house, his wife runs after him, catching things from the dustbin that he throws away. He throws everything out. You follow? So it depends on the basic personality. That's his nature. He throws everything out. So he can handle that. You know, there are two pathways. But if you want a general answer to your question, the general Torah answer to what you asked is that we don't try to chop off and sacrifice in a painful way. We try to channel in to use in a positive way. Many women have a problem. Many women have a problem this generation because they're talented in a way that has more difficulty applying in a kosher way. For example, I've spoken to a few women recently who are talented singers. A few women. A woman shouldn't sing in front of a man. Okay? A woman is not allowed to sing. Kol B'Isha Erevet says, a woman's voice is so sensuous that it comes into the category of things that shouldn't be revealed. To talk to this generation about these things is, you know, this generation's sensitivity is about, to get any sensitivity out of this generation, you have to bludgeon a person with a sledgehammer to get any twinge of sensitivity out of it, because they're so battered, you follow, by overdone, sensuous input, that there's just nothing left. And that's, of course, our marriage is the flattest experience there could be these days. That's not the Torah. Torah approach is a very heightening, great heightening of sensuous emotion, because we keep it in its correct place. Right? Mikveh laws add to that and many other things. But it should be that a woman's voice should be in the area that it's considered of amazing modesty for her to use only correctly, which means to be exposed only in places that, for let's say, a husband or father or people that she'd be allowed to expose herself in that way to. So what happens if a woman's very talented in that way? What does she do? Right? So you find that there are women who've used it in the most amazingly creative way. There are many, many examples. In Jerusalem, there's a whole group of women who have put together fantastic productions, right, and recordings, and talented writers, talented actresses, talented singers. In Johannesburg, there's a move. If you speak to me privately, I'll tell you also there's a movement of women who've recently got together to produce, and they have produced wonderful things already. So there's certainly a kosher way of using those talents, and you have to know. And even much cruder, things that are not so refined, that are talents or that a person's good at, he has to know also where to channel them. It can be very, very beautiful and wonderful things. There's nothing that's innately bad. That's our attitude to that question. Okay, so what have we learnt? We've learnt this, that this business of a share in the world to come, or losing a share in the world to come, is simply a translation. It's just another way of saying, what are you as a human being? Right? Meaning, what have you worked on and what have you developed in yourself that you weren't before? That is what the, and that's why I said that you can sense your world to come right now. You don't have to wait to be surprised when you get there. You know whether you've worked on yourself or not. Right? For most people, it's a frightening experience because most people haven't begun. Even the concept of working on themselves is not something that the Western world teaches in any way. So most of us don't even have that as an ethic of actually working on yourself. You'll find that most people who do manifest any refinement or any, it's actually from a vested interest because they feel good doing that. So they're very hard to manifest something that you do out of genuine sense of because it's right or out of a sense of giving. That's a lifetime of work. But that's what it is. Now, with that background, we can just take a few more minutes to understand that is the introduction. The first thing the Rambam said is people who don't live that way, so they don't have that. And we tried to explain this evening that it's not as a punishment, it's just a consequence. Now let's see, just introduction to the next one, and perhaps we'll leave it there unless there are any questions. I'm just going to read it to you and give you a brief introduction to it so you can think about it for the week, those who come next week, and we'll try and discuss it next week. It's a fascinating subject. Let me read it to you. First of all, again, somebody who says there is no transcendent reality, that's one. Now, two, somebody who says that there is a transcendent energy, being, there is that, but there are two or more. You hear that? Somebody who says that the source of the existence of the world, energy or matter, is actually more than one. But that's a breakdown of the oneness. I'm not going to go into it this evening, except just to put in one last idea, which ties together the first and second. Where do people come up with such an idea? We discussed this a little bit last week and the week before. Where do people come up with such an idea? By looking at the world. Since they see a world of divided realities, they don't see a world of oneness, so they come up with the conclusion that the source must be more than one. Now, this is not such a crazy idea. Not such a crazy idea. Because we know that the physical reality reflects exactly the spiritual reality. And therefore, if we see a world that's made up of a multiplicity, so it must reflect the spiritual source like that. You have to look much deeper into the world to see the source of oneness. Right? And that's what we started with this evening. The question is, what conclusion you come to from what you see? Right? We pointed out last week, I didn't give you this example, that two people can look at the same evidence and come out with completely different conclusions from that evidence. The classical and frightening case is what the Rambam himself mentions. He says, he gives the following example. He says, he's talking about Christianity. He talks about Christianity. He talks about Islam also. In that place, much of it was expunged, censored from our edition. But you can still get editions that have it in. He says the following thing. Where did they come up with an idea of threeness? After what we've studied together, those who've been here for a few months, you should already be able to trace it, because we've discussed so many times the mystical basis of how one becomes three. And it's obvious. We know that every idea in Christianity comes from a Kabbalistic Jewish source. We know that. It's based on a very true and deep, authentic Torah source, but applied in a way that we wouldn't agree with. Right? Sometimes we don't disagree with it when it's for them, but we disagree with it when it's for us. And sometimes, overall, it's not valid. Where did they come up with this threeness? Where did they come up with the idea? Where's the source? Now, they believe in the Bible also. They also believe in Torah. But they have Chumash also. Right? They just add on to it, but they have that also. So where did they come up with it? So now, before you answer, we have an axiom like this, that anything in the world that reflects a person's opinion, he will find, right, in the same source as the opposite opinion. In other words, if I hold something and I show you a source for it, there's an axiom that you can see the same source proving the opposite thing exactly. Right? Which means that if someone does have an opposite opinion to you, you should be prepared to have him show it to you from the very source that you show him your attitude. That's a rule in the spiritual world. So understand, there are two ways of arguing against the truth. One is to argue that the other person is saying something that's irrelevant. What you're speaking is not relevant. You're talking about another subject. That's one. That's a very painless way of arguing. But the bitter arguments in the world, the violent and bitter, bloody arguments in the world that have caused many of us to be butchered for centuries, is the kind of argument where the other person says, no, you are talking about the right subject, but you're reading the facts exactly wrong. He doesn't say that you're talking about the wrong subject. He admits you're talking about the right subject. He just says that you're reading the facts upside down. He's reading them correctly. You follow me? That's how all the worst arguments in the world are. If you think about it, you'll see also in human relationships. People don't argue. People don't say that they don't do that. They show the same thing and they say, it's your fault. What do you mean it's my fault? That very thing's your, the same action. No, turn it exactly around. That's where you have all the bitterness. If somebody would come home and say, well, that's very nice, but I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about this. So fine, you know, so marriage could succeed that way. But it doesn't happen that way. It's the very fact that you... So where do you think they got the idea of a Trinity? Answer's obvious. Shema. They took it from Shema. Do you know that? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. What does that statement mean to millions of Jews? To every generation of Jews that's ever lived and died for it? It means here, O Israel, Hashem is one. You know what they heard in it? Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. That's what they said. They said, you see, the primal statement of faith, the primary statement of faith actually talks about three. It says Hashem Elokeinu Hashem, and all those three, Echad, are one. That's where they heard it. You follow? And on that they built. Not so you have to understand it because it is based on the kosher idea, as we've discussed here many times. And therefore, what conclusion do you take out of what you see? And even more extreme, the Rambam himself says, what can I do? The Rambam says, what can I do? I'm not better than Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the way he puts it. He says, I'm not better than Moses. Moshe Rabbeinu himself wrote, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and they've taken it to mean three. So how am I going to explain it to you? So he says, how can I put it across if that's what they've done? The Torah says there was a man called Bilam. Bilam, right, was the most greatest prophet that the world ever had. In some ways he was greater than Moses. In some ways he was greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. He was an incredible insight into the spiritual world. Right? No one ever appreciated the Jewish people as much as he. No Jewish prophet. It's an incredible thing. His words are reported in Chumash. You know, when you go through the Jewish prophets, you look in Tanakh, you'll find occasionally praises of the Jewish people. Usually you'll find criticism. Almost always you'll find the most terrible criticism. Right? But occasionally you'll find praise from our own prophets. The praise that the greatest of our prophets ever said about us never amounted to anything compared to what Bilam said. He was an enemy of the Jewish people. Right? He was a very evil man, a man sunk in the most abysmal physicality. He married his donkey, it says. He married his donkey, that was his wife. Right? Literally, physically, it says. Right? He was steeped in the greatest, that's who he was. And that man was able to appreciate the essence of the Jewish people greater than anybody on earth who ever lived. Right? And his words are recorded in a lengthy speech in Chumash, which is one of the most beautiful things you could ever hope to read. Ma toivu alecha Yisrael, mishkan asecha ya. How great are your, how goodly are your tents? That's a quotation you'll see in every shul just about. Those words were said by one of the most, the evil geniuses that the world ever saw. But no Jew ever came up in a praise like that. Little children say it every morning. And some people, every time they come into shul, they say, Ma toivu alecha Yaakov, mishkan asecha Yisrael. How great are your, that's what it is. He said that. But what did he say right after that? What did he say right after that? What was the next word? He said this incredible speech of perception of what the Jewish people were. And right after that he said, Hashem Kalein, wipe them out. That was his conclusion. You follow? That means he perceived the greatest people on earth at the height of their spiritual being when they were in the desert to receiving the Torah. He perceived that. What was the conclusion that he drew from it? Wipe them out. You follow? In other words, how do you look at the facts? You make up your own conclusion. You make up your own. Look at the world. You want to see it one way? Right? That's what it means. Here are the facts. Nu. That's the big word. That little word, that's the big word. Nu. So what? So you see a world like this that has all this intricacy and this and this and this and so forth and so on that you're going to study for the rest of your life. So now what are you going to do about it? So nu. So, yeah. And you hear it in the West, in the Western world. What do they say? Observe a fact 100% accurately. And what do we do about it? For example, tomorrow we die. Right? That's what it says. Tomorrow we die. That's the sentence of man. It's quite correct. Quite correct. Right? Nobody walking around here was here 150 years ago. Right? Everybody thinks that they are going to be 150 years from now, but actually nobody is. So that's quite correct, that observation. So what should we do about it? Eat, drink, and be merry. That's a conclusion. Right? Now you've got a short time. You might not be here tomorrow. Let's live it up. Let's act like a gorilla. The Jewish people says, we're not going to be here tomorrow. Let's make it count. Let's make it pay. You follow? The facts and the observation are always the same. Everybody gets that right. We don't accuse them of not seeing accurately. Absolutely, they see accurately. The question is, what's your conclusion? That's up to you. No, let's leave it.